Podcasting with Kerry Jones.
This week's guest is Alan Rees, one of Wales's leading sea trout anglers. He shares his knowledge and experience spanning almost 40 years fishing for these enigmatic silver tourists. I have known Alan for nearly 10 years through working together on various publications and also as a friend. So I invited Alan over to my studio for this, the first weekly podcast episode. So sit back, enjoy and listen to Alan as he takes us into the sometimes secretive and romantic world of fly fishing at night for the sewing of the rivers of Wales. Welcome, Alan. I appreciate it you coming today, especially as you tell me it's your week's holiday off work, yeah?
Yeah, but anytime we talk about fishing, it's always good, you know? So yeah. Thanks for having me.
Have you got anything planned to fish this week?
I was hoping to go over to the Lower Esk because there's plenty of salmon coming in.
Is there?
I was also hoping to hit on the Ogmore because there's plenty of salmon in the Ogmore. And the sea trout is starting to make an appearance, so that's also good.
I was going to head off down to Ogmore this week just to fish the estuary and have a go at the bass and the mullet. But it's a bit quiet, I've heard.
Yeah, it's still a bit early. The mullet are making an appearance, one or two bass, but I think the water is still coldish after the spring. You know, right. We had all that water during the spring, and it's only now that temperatures are starting to rise, really.
Yeah.
So it's still a bit early in the season. I know it's July, moving into August. When's August? Next week, is it?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. I think
what is it now, 22nd or something? July is another week or so.
2 weeks, August. But more bass will start to appear towards the end of August, September, and then we'll start to see the bigger ones then.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
But going back to, how do we meet?
A new magazine kicked off. Andrew Petherick was the editor. It could have been Today's Fly Fisher, and he wanted articles on a countdown or something like that. Here's some fly tying materials, tie some flies, go and catch a fish. We tried it a number of times, or myself and Andrew Petherick tried it a number of times, but the water was too high, the weather wasn't good. And then eventually, I think both of us went down to the Ogmore.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. And I took you to a couple of spots where we could look at fish. I think one of the ones was the Swanee Run underneath the M4 bridge. And we were looking and I said, look, all of a sudden, all these sea trout, you went, wow, look at those. So, but we eventually went down to the Merthyr Mawr stretch. But the water was high. We stayed on a little bit after dark then. And I eventually landed the one fish. It went from there then. I think you wanted to find out a bit more about sea trout, and we fished the Neath a couple of times.
Yeah, I joined the Neath with you as well then, a couple of seasons there.
Yeah, and eventually Russell came down then to do an article.
Russell Hill.
Yeah, I think that's where you met Vaughan Thomas because you did an article on bass fishing with Vaughan.
That's right, that was a good one then.
Yeah, You were looking to do a couple of articles and maximise Russell's time in Wales.
Like. Yeah.
So
I remember because Russell stayed here, didn't he? And then you came over and we had a pint then.
That's right, yeah. We went up the local. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we went down to the Towie. We weren't successful, but we were supposed to go on the River Neath. But at the time, I think someone was doing work in on or near the Neath, and it was just clay coloured.
Yeah.
So it wasn't suitable to fish.
Because at that time, I didn't offer an awful lot of fly fishing, and I don't know if it's the case of you just get stale, you're catching the rainbows and you're fishing the fisheries. And I was looking for something different, and it was brilliant for me. It was like a new ball game, sea trout fishing. It was totally different. And you do it in a dark, and there's that romance about it. And it's not knowing, really. I've had one or two days down the Tyvee, or nights rather, and I've had some success. But I think with sea trout fishing, if you don't do it all the time, you're just waiting for the nod.
That's right. I mean, you came down the Neath one evening with me, and you'd obviously spoken to Malcolm Edwards because you had Malcolm Edwards' flies in your box and what have you.
Yeah, from the Rydal.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I think he's dead now, isn't he?
Yeah. Sometime now.
But you had his squirrel blue and silver Waddingtons and his squirrel orange and gold. I think those are the two flies he used to catch the majority of his big fish. I think with the sea trout fishing, people tend to they tend to apply what they know to the situation then. Yeah. So if they've been still water anglers, they turn up at the pool, cast the fly in, and they think, well, yeah, eventually I'll catch fish, and maybe that will work. But sea trout fishing is a totally different ball game because, you know, the fish themselves are migratory. So even while they're in the river, they're only going to be there for a transitory period. So they might be in one pool one evening, and then the following evening disappear. And, you know, the secret to catching sea trout, I suppose, is knowing when there's fish in front of you. So, and that can't be done over one evening. It needs application, and I Russell was down that time. He asked me what did I feel angling was missing at this moment in time. And I just said to him that anglers nowadays just don't do an apprenticeship. They can turn up at a fishery, they can buy an outfit, buy some flies, have half an hour's casting lessons.
Catch a fish.
Plonk a fly in, catch a fish and go, well, hey, is that all there is to it? Because it's that easy nowadays. Whereas, you know, there's so much on YouTube, you've got Facebook, you've got magazines, you've got all sorts of information that when we were starting out, there was none of it, was it?
But it's wild as well, isn't it? You know, you just can't. And with sea trout fishing, what I've found is you've got to put a lot of time. Probably, in my experience, it's like you might go 7 days or 7 nights, and only one night you'll have a fish. You'll have 6 blanks compared to your one night. So the amount of time and hours you put into it, no wonder it's secretive, because you don't want to just give that information freely. And I remember when I was with Malcolm Edwards that one time.
Right.
I met up with him, and then we drove down, and he said, look at that car there now. And it was a car beside the river. He said, that guy has been watching me for weeks. And he said, but little does he know, that's where I park my car, he said. I park it there, people think I'm catching my fish there. He said, I park the car there, I walk a mile and across the river then, up the other side. So he said, people will, as soon as they know you're successful, they want to steal those ideas. They don't want to put the time in.
No, that's right.
It was quite funny.
Yeah, they all want shortcuts. How can I become successful straight away? And sometimes there are no shortcuts. You know, I can give you a couple of examples. One young lad contacted me and he said, look, I've been fishing the River Neath for 2 years. I haven't even caught a fish. So I met up with him one night and we went down to the riverbank and we sat there. Just general chit-chat. I was looking at his flies. I was looking at his gear and, you know, just getting to know each other, really. Dusk started to come in and I said, well, best you tackle up now. And he said, well, what fly line should I use? And I said to him, well, what line do you like using? He said, well, I like to use a floater. Put it on. So what length of leader? What length of leader do you like using? And he said, well, about 10 foot. Well, put it on. Should I use a dropper? Do you usually use a dropper? Yeah, he said. And I said, well, put a dropper on. He said, what flies should I use? And I said, what flies do you like using? And he said, well, I usually fish these two. And he kept looking at me and I said, well, is there something wrong? And he said, this is what I've been doing for the last 2 years and I haven't caught a fish. And I said, well, never mind. Stand in this spot, cast to that spot. And as he came round, line went out to his hands, hooked into a fish. 3-pound sea trout.
Nice.
And he was like, how did you know? What happened? And I said, the difference is I've done my homework. Where you've been fishing, there may not have been any fish. But I've passed this point 3 times today, and I've looked and looked and looked. Tide came in at such and such a time. It dropped fish in. I watched them come up the river and I watched them settle in this pool. So the difference between what you've been doing and what I've been doing is I fish where the fish are.
Yeah, yeah. And they've got to be there. You're not going to catch them if they're not there.
That's right. It's a simple matter. And that's where the homework comes in. That's where the feel of the river, knowing that you've had a spate, you know fish have come in, you've got to then go and search for the fish, probably at the expense of not catching. But if you get indications of where the fish are, that once you've found them, then you can go and fish for them.
What I learned as well, just through after the first few outings with you in the night underneath, is that the fish don't read the same box as us.
No.
Because, right, we'd have, it was like, you know, it was a perfect evening. Many times we'd go, and it was dark, obviously dark, you know, and the clouds is the cover, and you read all the box, and you think, this is it. You know, there was a bit of water, so you think there's fresh fish in there. And you might not even see a fish. And I remember the best fish I had underneath one night. Do you remember?
Yeah.
It was
a
full moon.
That's right, yeah.
It was cold.
Yeah.
And I had just over £5.
And that was on one of Malcolm Edwards's.
Yeah, it was.
It was the squirrel blowing silver, I think.
So if you wait for the right conditions, you'll probably never catch fish.
No. And you picked on the best point there. You've got to do it all the time, regardless of outcome. The one thing about sea trout fishing is, in other forms of fishing, if you don't catch, then you are perceived to be less than successful. But in sea trout fishing, it's perfectly acceptable. If someone says to you, have you had any fish? And you say, well, no, I haven't had a touch. Nobody thinks any worse of you. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah,
It's just par for the course.
Yeah.
But if you get a fish, then people admire that fish, not because, or you are the one that's caught it, or it's a big fish or a small fish or whatever. It's because you've succeeded where others might not have. And it's not an envious reaction. It's like, oh, what a nice fish. What was the fight? How did you find it? What flies were you fishing? What depth were you fishing? There's a whole content behind just catching a fish. But if you don't catch, then nobody thinks any worse of you.
So do you actually fish at all much in the day?
Yeah.
And you catch?
Yeah, in recent years, many of my sea trout have come during the day. It's kind of a variety of methods, and I'd obviously spin for them. So coming from the spinning background, you know, flying condoms, Rapalas, all of those, when there was a bit of water on, you could not guarantee a fish, but within reason,
if they're there, you'd have them.
Yeah, you'd catch them. And I'll come on to something else about that, because that relates to flies. So one of the noticeable things about fishing during the day is that when you fish a spinner, you generally have a swivel up the line, a ball bearing swivel, because otherwise the line would start coiling, you get a bird's nest and what have you. When you're spinning, you're hoping, you're pulling back the lure, and you're searching for that spinner in the water, looking, see if anything's following so you can react or what have you. And out of nowhere, often, sea trout will come out and smack the hell out of the swivel.
Will it?
Right. Why, I don't know. It's just look, that flash of silver, they've hit your swivel. Now, if I'd put a small treble or a small hook on that swivel, I probably would have caught more sea trout on that swivel than on the actual lure at the end of the line. So
you've sold your fly tying gear, no?
Yeah. Ball bearing swivels are quite expensive, yeah. But I suppose sea trout fishing by day in Wales is not practiced as much as it is elsewhere in the UK. For example, in Scotland, they generally fish small flies during the day, sometimes at night, but really small flies. I fished regularly with another good friend, Jonathan Jones, and he used to fish on the Dovey, and they liked daytime sea trout flies up there. Now, Jonathan had some small doubles. I don't know whether he'll thank me for this, but, you know, credit where credit
is. I have to get him in. I've told him to come in, actually. Oh, great. He's up for it.
Yeah, well, yeah. Anna, he's Siarad Cymraeg as well. So,
indeed, man, indeed.
Yeah, so...
Do you Siarad Cymraeg?
Nah.
Dipyn bach, yeah.
Yeah, right. Tipyn bach, yeah. Jonathan is a different kind of angler, and maybe we'll touch on that sometime later.
Yeah.
But he had a couple of flies, and it wasn't so much the flies, but the method that he used, okay? And he would use these flies and cast upstream of square, maybe put a downstream mend in, and that would ensure that the flies came across the flow at a really good speed. So depending on the flow would depend on how much he'd strip or how little he'd strip. But often what you'd find is you'd either get a take straight away or at the end of the cast. Because I think it was like sort of this ball bearing swivel effect that these flies being small, silver in body, they were little flashes in the water that would cause these fish just to look up, what's that, turn, smack.
Yeah.
On they would go. If they didn't, because of the way the line curved in the water, you know, initially the flies would be retrieved downstream, then they were across the flow. At the end of the cast, once again, they would sweep back upstream, so change direction.
So they would take just because of being inquisitive.
Yeah.
And like an attraction.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But did you find that, you know, people say the salmon don't feed, obviously, in the rivers. And,
yeah.
You know, but you do catch fish, the salmon, on prawns or worms or on flies, you know.
Yeah.
But I think sea trout, as a trout, they do feed, I guess. Do they feed on insects and do they turn back into a trout as such?
Yeah, and this... Once again, is a wide topic. I suppose, you know, good migratory rivers are really rubbish brown trout rivers because those fish can't get to that size if they stay in that river. So they have to go to sea. But, you know,
that makes sense.
You fish the Neath with me. There's very few brown trout in there other than the ones that the club stocked. And typically, you know, look at the Esk. It's a great salmon river. A really bad sea trout river. Well, it's a really bad sea trout river because it's a good brown trout river. So though that stock
either or
has stayed in that river and not gone to sea and become sea trout or become a species that migrates from the river, whereas the salmon did. There are some exceptions to that. You know, the Tyvee in the upper reaches is a really good brown trout river. You know, what's his name? Kite. Used to go
Oliver
down
Oliver Kite.
Yeah, Oliver Kite. You know, he used to love to fish the Tyvee because that's where Kite Imperial was born, look, you know. So there are exceptions to the rule, but generally, a good sea trout river is a really bad brown trout river.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because that stock migrates to sea.
Yeah.
So coming back to what you were saying about feeding and what have you, I have caught sea trout that have had winkles or crustaceans in them, but they have been straight in off the tide.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I haven't done many autopsies because now if I catch a fish, generally it just gets returned. I guess
as well, because sea trouts, I suppose they come, the peak time is really, I guess, now, isn't it?
July,
August. So there's not a great deal, perhaps I'm wrong in saying this now, the fly life, like in the spring, you know, in the spring, you get hatches of everything, all the brown trout, that's their peak.
Yeah.
So when they come in, they're not probably thinking of feeding.
No, that's right. That's right. And they generally, as the season goes on, the flies that hatch get smaller because it's just the way of things. At the beginning of the season, the flies are bigger, then they get smaller and smaller and smaller until it tapers off and there's no more flies hatching. So
I remember once... it always, every time I see them, you know, the foxgloves,
yep.
The purple foxgloves, like, you know.
Yep.
I remember years ago, I was with Mark Morgan, and he pointed out, he said, as soon as you see these foxgloves come out, that's when the good sea trout normally come into the river, he said. Do you find that?
Yeah, three things, wild garlic, foxgloves, and a cuckoo.
Is it?
Yeah, because the cuckoos usually come over in May, But then they're starting to chirp and, you know, call out throughout late May, early June. And over the seasons that I've fished, the larger sea trout tend to enter the river early season. So from...
It's like salmon then, in effect, isn't it?
It's the first like fish salmon.
Usually, yeah, the yeah. spring ones, yeah.
Yeah, it's like spring salmon. And then as the season goes on, so you could say April, you get in large double-figure fish. May, you get in 8-9 pounders. June, you get in the 4 and 5 pounders. July and August, they are the bread and butter of sea trout fishing. They're schoolies or shoalies, depending where you're from. Yeah, and yeah. They're only about £1, £2 in weight.
And do you know what? Before you come, I made notes now of what we're going to talk about, right?
Yeah.
They've gone out the window now. I wanted to touch on in the beginning of how you started with the sea trout, you know?
Yeah,
we'll go back to the techniques and the rivers
yeah.
and the flies as well. And one in particular, I think we'll touch on now. But what actually started you off and how did you get into sea trout fishing?
Well, it's always been, fishing in general has always been part of my life, you know? And in the beginning, I started tying flies before I started fly fishing. It was down to Woolworths, Black Prince, fiberglass rod, worms, down the River Cannon. Then in the
What's Black Prince? The fly you mean?
Oh, no, the Black Prince was a spinning reel for my 6-foot fiberglass rod. Yeah, jeez, that's
Black
when.
Prince. Yeah. I think that's before my time.
Oh. Yeah, that was down there. You know, the Woolly special where you could buy everything and what have you. But it was just bullheads and stone loaches and the occasional trout out of the river when the pits were closed, really, because other than that, it was always Bible black, as they say in Wales.
Yeah.
Do you know? So
it's from a Dylan Thomas and Dimmelquid, yeah.
All right.
Bible black.
Bible black, yeah. Well, yeah, it was minus fortnight. That's when I'm sure all the trout I caught as a young kid had emphysema because of all the cold. You know, so it was around the mid-70s when my old man, he started fishing on Llwynon and Cantref and the Beaton's Reservoir. That's when
I used to as well, yeah.
Yeah, that's when the explosion was. And he'd come back and say, oh, I can't afford to buy these flies. Can you make these for me? And
was it? That's how you started? Yeah, tying flies for your father?
So I started tying flies. And I probably tied flies for 3 or 4 years before I started.
Really?
Yeah, fly fishing. Look, so wow. that was when I was about 8 or 9, I suppose.
And then you bought the magazines then, did you?
Yeah. Well, he used to buy Trout Fisherman and Trout and Salmon, and I used to follow Davy Wootton.
Yeah.
I mean, with his big whiskers, his deer stalker hat. But every month I look forward to Trout Fisherman because he used to have a good spread on tying flies, whether it was mallard and claret or some black pennel or even a fully dressed salmon fly.
He's probably one of the gods of fly tying, really, isn't he?
Oh, yeah.
He started so much off, and in fact, I've been messaging him this week. I'm going to do an episode with him, a telephone chat, because he's in Arkansas now.
Is he?
Yeah.
Right,
and,
yeah.
I think he's guiding on the White River, and he's doing all sorts of things, but amazing fly tyer.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And we all stand on the shoulders of giants. The current climate where everybody wants their 5 minutes of fame or what have you, what they tend to forget is that some of this stuff has already been done. You know, in fly tying, for example, there are very few new techniques, but there are new materials. But the concept or the idea for something new has already come from somewhere else. Typically, a snake fly, for example, one of the famous Welsh flies, I suppose, or style of flies, Hardy's had them in their catalogue at the turn of the 18th, 19th century, or 19th, 20th century, sorry. Yeah, yeah. But they were called demons and terrors. But the hooks were still on them.
Yeah.
Right? So they were multi-hook lures. And then you come forward and Falkus is sunk lure. And then you come forward into the late 60s with Mark Morgan and Graham Harris, the Marhog series, you know, the night series, where they had a front hook and a trailing treble, but with Mylar over that.
So as regards the when you start Italian then, so when you started fishing then, you used to go with your father to Llwynon and places, was it?
Yeah, well, we always fished when we went on holiday. Whether it was down the south coast in Devon, we'd mackerel fish or rock pool. But in general, we went to West Wales. And in West Wales was the River Teivi.
Right.
And that was throwing a number two or number four meps upstream and dragging it back, or plonking a worm in, or even if we were on a certain farmer's ground without camping, we went. It wasn't glamorous or whatever. But over night time, come on, boy, we're off down to the river. And that's where my sea trouting actually started.
Do you actually remember the first sea trout on a fly?
Yeah, it was probably from the River Teivi.
Was it?
Yeah, on an Alexandra. Yeah, on an Alexandra. It was only about 3/4 of a pound.
Yeah.
Because the Teivi has thousands of those. You know, it's probably the most prolific river in Wales, but not for size.
No, I actually, my first sea trout experience was on the Teivi. And the very first night I went, I caught four. And they were all round about 1.25 pounds.
Yeah.
You know, but great sport. I loved it.
Yeah.
And it was just a case of like casting across the pool, and the flies were coming round at the tail of the pool where the fish were just coming in, and psh, they were going.
Yeah.
And, but again, obviously, I fished different waters then. And, but as you said, I've been once or twice since, and the Teivi, you get more sport, but smaller fish.
Yeah. More fish are caught on the Teivi than, say, the Towie. The quality and size of a Towie fish is, you know, 2.5, 3 pounds, whereas the Teivi is generally £1, £1.25. So,
what is your best fish?
Oh, about 14.5, and that's off the River Neath, that is.
Was it 14.5 at night?
At night, yeah, 14.5.
Did you know the fish was in the pool beforehand?
No. The fact about it is you fish in the water, whatever grabs it, it's electrifying at night, you know. It really, I'm in, what have I got? Whoosh, out to the water.
Your senses heighten, what I've learned, like, you know.
Yeah.
Even if you get a little brownie, which is pulled, your line, you're fishing for the sea trout and it's dark, it's like electric shock.
Yeah.
Because you're waiting for that take.
Yeah. It's anticipation. And sometimes, to your detriment, you know, you got lightning reflexes, horned over many night sea trout fishing, into the fish, he's out of the water, and then gone because you struck too early.
Yeah.
So.
But the anticipation, I find as well, walking across a field in the dark.
Yeah.
You know, and you can hear noises around you. You can hear, like, it's quite a funny experience. You hear sheep coughing and cows coughing. Yeah, and they sound human.
Yeah.
You know, and you think someone's there, like, you know.
Definitely.
And I remember fishing the river with Tony Davis years ago down in West Wales. Not sure if, I think it was the, down by Newport Way somewhere, and then could have been, and he was a guide in, he was taking somebody fishing, and he was a guy from the city,
right,
and he was a wealthy guy, and he I think he flew in, and he had a couple of days on the river, I think it was a Towie actually, and so I was fishing further on up, and then Tony came and talked to me in the night, and then, so this guy was fishing on his own, couple of, I don't know, 50, 60 yards further down.
Yeah.
And then me and Tony were just talking, whispering really quiet. And next thing I could hear, it was a cough. And it was, I think it was a cow in the dark.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden we could hear this voice. Who's there? Who's there? And this guy thought somebody was in the field creeping up on him. And he was saying, I know you're there. Who's there? But he was a cow, you know?
Yeah.
And me and Tony, we were crying, laughing, you know?
I bet, yeah.
Another story I got to tell you as well is I fished a few times with John Wilshaw, which used to be the editor of Trout and Salmon.
Right, yeah.
And I've been to a few places with him, but he was telling me this one story. And he was fishing the Rydal.
Right.
And something happened and he got spooked. He thought, I'm not staying here, you know? I'm going to go.
Yeah.
So he got out of the river and he ran across the field to his car. He couldn't wait to run, right? And as he ran across the field, He hit a cow sleeping. And you can imagine it. You're running across the field, you hit the cow. Ooh, jumped more. I don't know, the cow or him.
Yeah.
And this cow got up, a big warm thing you imagine you're falling on. He said it was terrifying. And I can imagine. But, you know, the whole night experience, I suppose the stories you can draw into it. It's a whole romance. It's a different thing altogether.
Yeah,
just being there, listening to the owls as well, and things creeping and around. And
yeah, well, some of the stuff you're talking about owls. You know, I used to fish a small stretch of river, and there was a nice meadow next to it. And every evening, I used to see two barn owls working that field, that meadow. And you know, when they're in flight, they're absolutely silent, and they're only small birds, but they're really good. But you know, you were talking about cows. I'd staked out this pool on the River Tyvee. Okay, it was above Llandyssil there, and I knew they were fishing there because I'd been down and I'd looked. You know, I'd climbed a tree and seen these fish going around, and I sat there maybe 2 hours before dusk, and I thought, right, I'm going to be first on this pool, and as darkness started to come in, there was like sort of a high bank opposite, and I was sat there waiting, high bank opposite with some trees, and I heard some branches starting to crackle, and I was like, someone's going to come down the bank there and jump in the pool ahead of me. I'm not going to have that. And I waited and I waited, and these crackles and branches started getting a bit more and more. All of a sudden, there was a massive crack, and I found out later it was a fence post had broken. There happened to be a cow scratching its back against the fence. But when the fence post broke, the cow came tumbling down through the trees. down through the trees, off the bank, into the pool. And this cow was swimming in this pool going, moo, moo. I wasn't happy, I tell you. Right? And I thought, I'll give you moo, you whatever, right? The nearest bricks I could pick up, I was throwing them at the cow. I've been here 3 hours, smack, moo. And every time I hit the cow with a stone, it moved again. And I wasn't happy. But this cow, it got out the river. But, spoiling my night's fishing, that did.
Yeah,
unbelievable. But, you know, there's loads of stuff. You know, a favourite trick in Wales, I suppose, by poachers is to set night lines, and one of the guys, he jumped in the pool and started fishing down, and he thought
in the dark now,
right, and he heard a rustle in the trees, and he stopped and he thought, and then he took another step or two down the pool, and the trees went again, and he thought, who's there, and he turned his light down, and he said, I couldn't see anybody. But as he took another two steps, the branch rustled again.
I can see what you're going to say now.
Yeah. No, what it was, someone had tied a nightline along the branch and thrown it into the pool. And as he was wading down, he was pushing against the nylon, and that was causing the branch to move. But funny.
Because your senses is heightened. I remember on the Neath, one of the nights I was there by myself, actually, this one night. I was fishing and nothing much happened. One or two fish would splash in the pool. So I was like waiting.
Yeah.
Before I knew it, there was what I thought was a dog's head come right up, almost right by my legs, right?
Yeah.
And he just facing me. But it was a seal.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, a seal, a full-blown seal.
Bloody hell.
Yeah, must have come up from the sea, obviously up to the river.
Yeah.
And he was just looking at me. It wasn't totally dark at that stage. But your eyes get tuned anyway, don't they? And all of a sudden, he just popped up and he's looking at me. Well, geez, you know, it's just like, it's the last thing you expect.
Yeah.
So after seeing that, I thought, it's a waste of time you fishing this pool now.
Yeah.
So I just reeled in then. Going onto your fly tying. Do you still tie flies now?
Yeah, constantly, yeah. But I diversified a lot. I spent quite a lot of my adult life away. You know, I was in the army, so I was never at home. And whenever I got the opportunity, I'd come back and, have a couple of days of sea trout fishing. But I was never successful because I didn't get the feel. I didn't have the background. I didn't know where the fish were. I had a young family. My wife would look after the kids during the day. I'd finish work. She'd have her rest. I'd put the kids to bed and I'd go, right, I'm going fishing. Yeah, that's fine. So that's how my more modern time with sea trout have come back. But so
I suppose it's convenient, isn't it, to fish in the night?
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
If you haven't got time.
That's right.
You sleep less, I suppose, but...
But when you get to the river, it's all about maximizing, you know, you build up a network of friends and friends on the river or have you share ideas, and you go when the opportunities or the omens are good, I suppose, if you think. But yeah, with the fly dressing, initially, because access, as a young kid, I couldn't drive. I used to walk everywhere to go fishing, whether it was the River Cannon, the River Taff, or even the reservoirs in Llwynon and Cantref. To get there, I'd really have to walk. So my fishing as a youngster was more or less confined to still waters. So that's where the majority of my fly tying was centred on, you know, buzzers or traditional wets, or even at the time, marabou was making inroads. So any marabou-type fly, like a Viva or a Black Chenille, you know, we're going back some years now, so the appetizer and whatever.
I think when it comes to still water flies, what I've noticed, like years ago when I started off, you'd have lovely flies, traditional patterns, this, you know, Peter Ross, Sweeney Todd, Green Peter, Malden Claret, those sort of things are the nice flies to tie.
Yeah. Yep.
I think even though the materials have come leaps and bounds since then, the techniques and methods of still water fishing, you know, blobs.
Yeah.
Boobies.
Yeah.
You know, it's gone by. That's what I like about sea trout flies. They've kept that style nice, more classic look, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there's something which they look good framed on the wall as well as being fishing. They're still successful traditional patterns today.
Yeah. No, I agree. Well, in actual fact, one of my favourite sea trout flies is the Alexandra.
Yeah.
And my first introduction to it was on Llwynon Res, the Taff Fecha.
Yeah, yeah, on the Bracken.
It was at the time, it was late August, really, and there were rainbows starting to hit fry in the side, and I'd never seen it before. I was only a youngster, look. A guy was fishing, and he was casting his fly in the shallows, tweaking it back into a fish. Big rainbows, about 2.5-3 pound, where they were massive at the time. And I asked him what he was catching it on, or what he was caught the fish on. And he showed me an Alexandra, and I said, that's not an Alexandra as I know it, because, you know, I'd started purchasing books and seen the magazines.
Yeah.
And it was without the red ibis.
Yeah.
And he said, well, the thing is, if you look at the sticklebacks in the water at the moment, they're not in their mating colours. They're just the pearl with the green. And that's why he tied it like that. And I thought,
Left the red out.
Oh, hang on a second, I thought. But then I started noticing all of this coloration and why flies were styled the way they are. The Maladon Claret, Connemara Black, Invicta.
Invicta. The silver and the amber, the yellow. Two of my best flies years ago.
Yeah.
You don't fish them, no?
Well, you've been fishing Talibont recently. And it was always the case of Connemara Black on the point, Invicta on the top, on the dropper. And we would fish 10 yards from the river, or 10 yards from the lake. So you were casting over the lake bank into maybe 6 inches to a foot of water, and we'd hit brownies in inches of water. But there were two types. There were brownies feeding on the big sedges, and we'd grease up the Invicta so he skated along the top, or the ones that were they were eating caddis. When you caught them, their stomachs were like ball bearings because they were full of these case caddis, which the Connemara Black mimicked brilliantly.
Yeah.
So you were trying to maximize your chances. All these big red sedges fluttering, the brownies would smash off the surface. That's where the Invicta was. But the ones that were subsurface, picking off the caddis lava, that was the Connemara Black. Those flies, I still tie them now. Right? The only difference nowadays is what you want out of the fly. Because if you look at the traditional fly, yeah, they represent something. You know, the tippets of a black panel is supposed to be the shuck of a buzzer, or and the hackle in the body is the emerging fly. Nowadays, those flies still have their place, and I still use them. You know, the Alexandra, Connemara Black, Silver Stoat, Butcher, all great sea trout flies now.
Yeah, you touched on the Alexandra. I'm glad you did, actually, because I'm looking now. You've got a box here which you're giving me. I like gifts. And in here is a fly slightly reminiscent of the Alexandra, but it's your own tie-in. It's your own pattern you devised. It's the American Express, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's been around for some time now. How did this come about?
Well, now we're talking about all those old flies, right? Yeah. So the thing about sea trout fishing is, if you're not losing flies, you're not getting in the right places, okay? And so I only used to tie flies that were simple to tie to then go and fish. And I used to carry a box with me with maybe a dozen flies. And if those flies didn't work, it didn't matter.
Yeah.
You know? So I was out fishing a pool one night, and I knew there were fish out because I could see them either coming in to the pool or they were splashing.
Oh, what river was this then?
This was the River Neath.
Yeah.
And the only two flies I had in my box was an Alexandra and a Connemara Black. So I put both those flies on, one on the point, one on the dropper, and I caught fish after fish after fish. And I hooked unhooked the fish, put them back, or they got off. Didn't matter. I was having a whale of a time. And at the end of the night, I thought, well, I got work in the morning. I've got to go. Threw the rod in the car, didn't even tackle down, drove off, sleep. The following day, when I was sorting my gear out, I had a look at what my flies, or
the cast was on.
The cast. All that was left of the Alexandra was the peacock sword wing. The body and the rib and everything else had disappeared. And all that was left of the Connemara Black was the black and silver body.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, hang on a second.
Right, I see, it's concoction.
Concoction. You're looking at the fly there, and you can see the black and silver body of the Connemara Black, or albeit flat silver.
Yeah.
But the red and the red throat and the peacock sword over the top.
No tail, simple. Nope.
Yeah, reminiscent of the Alexandra, or the bloody Alexandra, I suppose.
And what hook is this?
Right, that's a Kamasan B800, but any long shank hook will do. You'll notice it's tied short.
Yeah. I like that.
Now, the thing is, at the time, there was another magazine called Game Fisher or Game Angler.
Right.
John Wilshaw was the editor of that as well.
Right.
And there was a letter in one of the back pages from a guy who fished the River Conwy. Up in North Wales, or Conwy, up in North Wales. He said he liked to tie his flies short so that the fish had to get more of the fly in its mouth.
Yeah.
So that the hook was further back. And I thought, okay, so what I'll do is I'll take the best of the Alexandra, the best of the Connemara Black, and tie it short. Hence, that's what it is. I did later find that it was nothing new, the shortened hook, because there was an author, and I'll find his name for you. He's written a couple of books, but he tied a fly called the Cock Robin.
Ah, my number one point fly in Ireland, that is.
Is it?
Yeah.
But right, well, this was his version of the Cock Robin for sea trout.
Right.
James Waltham, that's the guy. Right. And someone pointed out to me, oh, this is nothing new. This guy, James Waltham, this is his preferred method of tying these flies, tying them short so that the hook is hanging out further at the back, if you understand.
Yeah.
I'd never read the guy's book. I'd never seen it, so I obtained it, and yeah, great.
So you'd fish this on a floating line or an intermediate? Or?
Right. One other thing is, I rarely fish a floater for sea trout.
Rarely fish what?
Rarely fish a floater for sea trout. Yeah. My favourite go-to line has always been the Cortland Blue.
Yeah, yeah, I've got one.
Right? It's almost like a hover line. Masterline used to make some really nice hover lines that they were neutral density.
Yeah.
And they were true neutral density, you know.
They, like a burgundy colour, weren't they?
That's right, yeah. And they took an age to sink. If you're fishing these pools and the fish are 4 foot down, they might move 4 foot to come up to a surface fly. So on occasion, you have to go down for them. And the Cortland Blue was ideal because it sunk at such a slow rate that even in the pool tails, the sweep of the current would keep it mid-water.
Yeah.
So the only time I fish a floater is when I'm fishing a surface lure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I rarely fish a surface lure anyway.
So this is a point fly?
Point fly, mainly, a lot of people fish it on the dropper. And if...
A smaller one on the dropper, is it?
Yeah. And if you look at the style of fly, it's very light in the dressing.
Yeah, okay? Yeah.
And it
sinks better then, I guess, doesn't it?
No, that's the biggest point, right? The biggest point, and it's something that people tend to forget about fish, tend to forget about flies. They tie flies with lots and lots of materials on them, and they think, if I was a fish, then I would take this fly. And there's a word called anthropomorphism, and... I know it's a big word, right? But the thing is, Walt Disney was very anthropomorphic. What he did was he attributed human-like qualities to dumb animals, okay? So what people tend to do, they look at a fly and think, oh, if I was a fish, I'd definitely take that fly.
I can see, definitely, yeah. There's flies, some people's fly boxes you look at and you don't... They haven't got it. They might be fantastic fly tires.
Yeah.
But there's nothing fishy about them.
No, that's right.
And then sometimes you can look at someone's fly and think, geez, if I was a fish.
Exactly. Now, until we catch a talking sea trout or a talking salmon or a talking trout, we'll never know. But something will do for those fish that other flies won't. Now, one of the things about that
fly... definitely a fishy fly, this is.
Well, it was tied to fish specific spots. Pool tails, where the water is shallower, and it's tied slim like that because it's a quiet fly. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you get flies that are quiet and you get flies that are noisy. Now, if I try to explain that, if you fish a big, heavy fly in a pool tail, it makes such a noise in the water because the one thing that people forget about fish is they have a lateral line, and that vibration indicate to them something's in the water, where is it?
Yeah.
When you're fishing in shallower water, if you introduce a noisy fly into that water, all it's going to do is scare the fish. And I've seen it happen. You know, someone's put a 4-inch jumbo across a pool tail which is full of fish. It's about a foot and a half deep, and all the fish do is scatter.
Switch off.
They just go, wow, what's in the water? Wow.
Yeah.
Off they go. But when you introduce small, lightly dressed flies, they cut through the surface film and they're quiet coming through. Now, obviously, on the other side of that, if I was to fish a small, lightly dressed fly in a deep, dark pool, the fish might not know it's there.
No.
Right? So I'll fish something bulkier. And plus, you know, if you look at some tube flies, people take a certain length of time to create an exquisite silver body with the rib just perfect, and then they smack on a squirrel or all in around that just masks the body, and you're thinking, why did you spend all that time tying that really nice body and then just mask it with all this fur?
Yeah.
You can't see it. But likewise, that heavily dressed fly then, it's not going to sink at the same rate as a... lightly dressed
flies. It's obviously, I suppose, the depth of the pools and the amount of water coming through it.
Yeah.
What you would fish line-wise with it. But what generally, if you was going underneath now tonight, knowing there's, you know, there's a chance of a good fish, but you don't want to go over it heavy with nylon.
No.
Or monofilament. What's your typical
Well,
cast?
Typically, most of the flies in my fly box are tied for a time and a place. Now, I had a young guy out with me, really exquisite fly tyre, fantastic check nymphs, all dry flies, reservoir flies, really, really good. And he tied a whole box of flies. And he said, look at these. And he had red and yellow in their throats. And we were sat there looking at them. And I said to him, give me a fly box. Turn your headlamp off. So I turned my headlamp off. And I said, now, which black fly do you want to use? Right? Because at night, there's no white light. So you can't see it. But the fact of the matter...
So silhouette is everything, right? The shape.
Silhouette and speed.
Yeah.
Right? So... I think one of the reasons my success is because I spent an awful lot of time on the water, and I got to know in different heights what flies fish best. Not fly patterns, but fly sizes.
Yeah.
Right? And what I found is that if the fly comes across the current slightly faster than the current is,
yeah,
then those are the flies that are most successful. So I probably only got half a dozen patterns, but I've got them in various sizes. And when I jump into the pool, you know, my leader length might be 7 or 8 foot. I might put a dropper on, depending on depth and noise and what have you. I'll have a cast, and I'll have another cast, and I'll try to judge whether the size of fly I'm fishing is small enough for that current. So that when they come across, they're coming across slightly faster than the current is going. And the only way I can describe it is, if you look at a military fighter jet in the sky that's travelling at 400 miles an hour, you think, Christ, that plane is really travelling.
Yeah, yeah.
If you look at a jumbo jet that's doing 400 miles an hour across the sky, same speed as the military jet, you think, how is that staying in the sky?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The only difference between the two of them is the size of the object. So they're both doing 400 mile an hour, but because a jumbo jet is infinitely bigger than a military jet, it looks as if it's going slower. That's the impression you get. So this comes back to my choice of flies then. Depth of water, speed of current. I will put some flies on, and if I think they're coming around too slow, then I'll change them for small flies, and then they come around faster.
It doesn't matter so much with leader strength then. I suppose it's 8 pound thereabouts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well,
because when you're trout fishing, I find they got more time to look at your flies.
Yeah.
But when the fly's moving in a river, you haven't got to worry so much. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, 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 you are. And the biggest factor with monofilament is that if it's too stiff and the fly is small, fly will not swim.
No.
The strength of nylon, nothing to do with the size of the fish. Okay, it's all about making the fly swim better. So if you're using 20 pound, you've got a size 10 fly.
Yeah, it's not going to work, is it?
No.
No.
So you know where I'm coming from. But if I used 4 pound nylon and I had a 3-inch copper tube, that's not going to work either. So I know those are quite extreme, but ideally, it's all about making that fly swim.
So most of your sea trout fishing then is in South Wales?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Nowadays, because of work, I don't get the opportunity to travel as much as I used to. My work used to, in actual fact, I was a member of the Prince Albert Angling Association.
Right.
Or Angling Society. So they had water all over the country. And because of the nature of my work, I'd be traveling to the north of England, fish the Loon, the Ribble, the Hodder. They had water everywhere. So,
is there anywhere on your bucket list now you want to go? What about like Tierra del Fuego or something like that?
No, not really.
No,
not
Iceland.
Really. Iceland, yeah, Iceland.
I've had 2 trips in Iceland, and I've caught sea trout up to 10 pound in a day. They don't fish for them in the night, there.
No,
it's in the day, which is strange, really. Like, you know, you can catch them regularly in Iceland in the day, and come to Wales. Maybe it's because people just think you don't fish for them in the day over here or what? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm once again, you know, the rivers are different. Yeah, I'll talk about some salmon flies and what have you. You look at Michael Frode in salmon flies.
You'll have to come again. I tell you why, I haven't even looked at my notes now. There's so much information in our head when I get out with the flies, the fly tying, the techniques. You'll have to come back another time. One thing I want to touch on as well.
Go on.
Is I'm asking this to everyone, a memorable fish.
Right.
So before we touch again, we go back to doing some techniques and things. But in all your years you've been fishing, is there one or two experiences where you think, geez, you know, that was some story?
Yeah. There's two in particular. One was at Rutland. I know it's not sea trout.
Yeah.
Right? One was at Rutland. I love Rutland. It's the nearest thing to a wild place. You know, The fish,
it's such a big water, and they turn on naturally feeding quite quick because the abundance of food there, fly life, is just incredible. I've had some amazing times there. I'm looking forward to going back again. Again, I haven't been for a couple of years.
Yeah, I spent, I had a 3-day boat pass year before last, I think. Me and a friend went and...
3 days on Rutland?
Yeah.
Was that pass? If I remember right, because I've done it a couple of times, you can have like... One on Grafham, one on Pittsford.
Yep, that's
one
right.
One on Rutland. But you had 3 days on Rutland.
Three days on Rutland. Because the friend I went with, he'd never fished a big res before. We ended up in going across the dam where there were loads of fish just pulling little muddlers in the wave and up. They were chasing. It was almost like being on a wild loch. But they were, you know, 2-pound rainbows. But boy...
The thing is with Rutland, my experience over the years is, I mean, you could fish the basin and, you know, you get the run-of-the-mill 2-pound fish. But then, you know, we'd have club comps. We'd have a weekend up there ourselves, the fishing club. And then all the boats would be down the dam because they want to catch their 8 fish, you know?
Yeah.
And then, but I would just get on the engine right up the top of the north arm, the south arm. You get less fish, but boy, well, something else. You get like 3-4-pound fish.
Yeah. And you're saying there was another memorable fish on Rutland as well. And it was probably only my 3rd or 4th visit to Rutland, and we were up in the South Arm, okay? And you can tell how long ago it was by the style of flies I was fishing.
I thought you were going to say it was only oars then.
No. that's another story. That is on the oars. But we were up in the South Arm by the Buns there. We were waiting because we'd heard that there were good buzzer hatches, and you could see all in the cobwebs the size of the buzzers, you know, inch long, and you're thinking, oh, fantastic, waiting for this. And all of a sudden, the swifts started coming in, and they started screeching, and this buzzer hatch happened, and I've never seen another buzzer hatch like it. There was... Like coming off everywhere.
Big as well, are they?
Oh, yeah, massive. And they were fish. It just switched on like a kettle boiling. There were that many fish there. And the swifts were coming in, the swallows were coming in and screeching everywhere. And you can imagine this now. I'm like, wow, I'm in my fly box. It's thinking, what do I do? My mate in the boat, he just had a back operation he had. And... he said, oh, don't worry about it. Just use the flies you've got. And it was the era of the peach doll and stuff like that, right? You know, this is going back 80s. Years ago. Yeah, baby dolls and stuff like that. But I still had my sea trout flies on, like Connemara Black. You know, a fantastic fly anyway. So I thought, right, before I change, I'll make a cast. So I whacked out my fly and I put my rod down. And I was in my fly boxes. Next thing I know, my rod was bouncing over the gunwale. And I thought, whoa, I can't, my rod. And I reached for it. I stood up and reached for it. And the boat just went flip.
Well, the boat went flip.
Yeah, the boat went flip. It stayed afloat, but it flipped me out.
Oh, you fell in?
Yeah. I was in the water in the South Arm going, bloody hell. What and my mate was going...
Was he still in the boat?
Yeah, he was still in the boat. He was. And I was like, it was a perfect... It was like sort of a muggy day with overcast and clouds and what have you. And I was like...
No wind, no?
No wind. And...
How do you manage to fall in on a calm day?
Because well, there you go. My rod was going over. I stepped on the gunwale, reached for my rod, and the boat righted itself and flipped me out.
Right.
So anyway, my mate was in the boat going, are you all right? Are you all right? And I'm giving it, yeah. I've got my rod, and I'm playing a fish while treading water, look. And he was laughing.
Oh, you had a fish on?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The fish, the thing is, when they're feeding up there, those fish are travelling. They don't stop. They just mouths open and they're going, gulp, 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 you know?
It's giving me visions now of, what was that film now? A river runs through it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you're still playing a fish in the river?
Well, yeah, yeah. So I was in the water and he said, oh, bollocks to the fish, you know? Get back in the boat. So I pulled some line off and I was still treading water. Luckily, I'm a confident and good swimmer. I give him the rod.
It's the army training.
Yeah, well, there you go. But he just had a back operation and he was like, oh, I got to watch my back. And I went, don't worry, just pull me over. So I rolled in. And my rod nearly went out again. Grabbed that. Anyway, the fish I landed was about 4.5 pounds.
Wow. Rainbow?
Rainbow trout. But he was perfect. He just like the rainbows you described, that's, you know, right. Full tail, he had rays on it. It was just a perfect fish. And in his gob, just back from the scissors, was my Connemara Black.
Connemara Black?
Yeah, yeah,
Jesus,
yeah.
Yeah.
So we laughed about it. I had to get stripped off. I was starkers for most of it. But initially, he was worried that I was in the water and I was going to drown. But I was confident swimming. Yeah. And then he was worried he couldn't get me back in the boat because he just had a back operation.
You obviously didn't have a life jacket on then, no?
No. So well, we used to use them to sit on then, didn't we? it was a bit hard on the old backside on those thought boards, you know. So
bloody hell.
But that was a fantastic.
You'll have to have a day. I fancy a weekend up there.
Yeah,
I used to fish Chew a lot as well, but you know, it's just I think Rutland to me, you got the edge because the vastness, the big water. That's what appeals to me. That's why I go to Ireland.
Yeah.
It's because the vastness of it, the wildness of it, you know.
Yeah.
And I think the closest to, you know, like the Mask or the Corrib in Ireland we've got over here is like Rutland and Grafham.
Yeah, because of the size, you know. Yeah. When a wave gets up, I mean, you can be in the wave, but if those fish, like daddy time, you know, there's daddy long legs rolling down the waves and the fish are up there and you've got something, you can't cast far because you can't get a good back cast because the wind is so strong, but you're dibbling those things and up they come, slash at your flies, over your rod goes and you think, oh, here we go again. And I wouldn't say there's nothing like it, but it's a unique experience, you know. And even on the dries, when you know you're spotting a fish and you see one about 60 yards away and
you're gonna meet him,
you're counting, you're going 1, 2, 3, there he is again, 1, 2, there he is again, and you're going 1, 2, there he is again, and you whack over your line and you go 1, 2, give a little tweak on your dries, gulp, off you go. Visually, it's fantastic.
Yeah. It's something which I love, being on a drifting boat. I like bank fishing, but I'm definitely a drifting boat man. You know?
One memorable fish. And there's a phrase, it talks about, you know, the thinking angler will always outfish the non-thinking angler. I'd say much of my success with sea trout fishing has come from observation. And taking individual observations and making the link between them.
Yeah.
And I've taken you to this location, and when I remind you now, you will go, oh, I remember that. Okay.
And which pub was this?
But it, I took you into the river, and I one stretch where a glide of about three foot depth comes in, and all of a sudden it dips into a deep area of a pool. A run with a long glide that went into 3 foot, there was 3 foot in depth, or thereabouts anyway, and then it went into a deep hole. And you knew it was a deep hole because in the darkness you could see the surface of the water where there was a slow glide, and all of a sudden it stopped. And you thought, right. And directly opposite where I used to fish from was a tree. And I often went up that tree and looked in. And there was like sort of a kind of reverse slope on directly under the tree. And it was as if the fish sat on the reverse slope and allowed the current to go over the top of them. And it just cushioned them and kept them there regardless of whether it was in spate or they didn't have to expend any energy to stay in that location. And try as I might, over many, many nights and losing many, many flies, I finally thought I hit on a method to catch these fish. And it needed me to get into a certain spot in the pool, cast to a certain point on the opposite bank, wait for a certain time to allow these flies to sweep over the reverse hill, I suppose,
yeah.
Or the reverse of this underwater...
What do you mean by a reverse now?
So imagine if you're looking at a hillside, we'd see the hillside going up, the reverse would be the other side of the hill.
Oh, right, yeah.
Okay, so if you imagine we are looking on a flat meadow and then there's a dip.
Yeah,
at the end of it, yeah. That's what I'd mean about the reverse side. So
it's a drop-off.
That would be better description, actually. Yeah. Yeah, it was a drop-off in the water. But, I'm trying to think visually. So it was flat, and then it dropped off. And you knew there was a drop-off there because the surface current stopped.
Yeah.
Right? So I needed to find a way to get my flies into that drop-off without hooking up. Now, you'd like to think that you'd use heavy flies, but the heavy flies...
You get snagged before you get to the drop-off.
And because there was a lack of current, those flies didn't swim there.
Right.
Right? Because there was no current to move them, so they became the jumbo jets then, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But if I used small flies, they wouldn't get down to that point, even though they would fish nicely. So that's when I started experimenting with copper tubes. And what I found was that regardless of the pattern, these were just general black and silver flies. If I used two half-inch copper tubes in conjunction, and I cast to a certain point and I waited maybe 10 or 15 seconds, that my flies would sink and sweep across that drop-off. And to illustrate the point, I tied these flies up and I thought, right, I'm going to give them a go this night. But as it happened, there was about six people on the pool. Lots of fish had come in and what have you. So I was the last one to arrive. So by convention, I was the last one to go through the pool. So I waited and all these people, they fished here and they fished there and they'd gone through and everybody'd been in and out. They'd all come back out and I said, any luck, guys? No. We tried this, we've tried that. And I said, well, I just want to go into the corner of this pool and try this out.
And did you know there was a fish there?
Yes.
You'd gone over in the day to have a look?
Yes. And there'd been fresh fish come into the pool and they were there. And, these six guys had been in and out and splash, splash, splash. Besides that, the fish come out of the water just to say, hey, I'm here. Whether they were disturbed from the anglers or disturbed because there were fresh fish coming into the pool, I don't know. I got into this position, I pulled all the line out and I waited and things settled down. First cast, let's make it count. And out my flies went. First time it didn't reach where I wanted to. Second time I got hooked up on the other bank, so I had to tie some more flies on. Third time, out it went. I thought, right, I'm happy with that. And I waited for 15 seconds. Bearing in mind, the current was really, really slow. My flies got down to a certain point and I started figure eighting. And all of a sudden, it just went tight, as if you were nymphing.
Yeah.
You know? Or you just got snagged on the bottom and it tightened up. And I thought, I wonder. And I lifted the fish, lifted into the what I thought was a fish. And I held it there and I held it there. And then all of a sudden, the rod tip went bang, 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 and bounced over, and out came this fish of about 11 pounds. right? And splush, 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 quick as a flash, six people were over, headlamps on, going, oh, what have we got? What have we got? What have we got? Anyway, played the fish out.
And to think they'd fished it before then.
That's right. Well, yeah, long story short.
Danglers and danglers.
Well, different
methods, isn't it, as well?
It is, and...
Or they just left it for you.
Oh, well, no, they weren't that type of guys. So over they came. One of the guys brought a net and he lifted the net and he said, what are you going to do with it? And I unhooked the fly and I said, no, he's going to go back. Someone said, what did you catch it on? And I said, well, you saw the fly in the fish's mouth. Nah, I don't believe you caught it on that fly. And I'm giving it, really? Well, there you go then.
Was it a small fly? I know you've seen this copper.
Half inch. Is there? Yeah, yeah. So overall, even
so size doesn't matter then.
No. But it was the combination of the weight and the size that made that fly fish effectively in that spot. Yeah. And this is what I hopefully I've conveyed is that you know it's not a simple matter of looking in your box and thinking, oh, this fly will do. When you get to know the parts of the river that you fish, you know what flies will fish best. Not fly pattern, but fly size, fly weight in those certain parts. And, you know, when you fly your swim in effectively, then you're in with a better chance than, you know. You know the phrase I'm going to say. The wrong fly fished at the right depth and speed will outfish the right fly fished at the wrong depth and speed.
Yeah, that's good.
So I had looked for these fish and I tried to analyze how I could get there and how I could do this and what would work. And, some nights I'd lost 30 flies trying to get my flies to swim correctly in that spot. And it eventually culminated in that one fish, 11 pounds. Yeah, okay, he was a good fish. He was a fresh fish in the pool. The fish was secondary because I'd made these observations and I'd gone in. At that time, they'd worked.
It's nice when a plan comes together, doesn't
it? And that's right. But, you know, other nights I could go in and do the same and not catch a fish. But but on that night, it seemed to work. I remember taking you there with me.
I don't think I've had a fish from there.
No.
I hooked and moved fish from that pool, but it was other parts in the river I've had fish. But what I remember about it is how everyone is so, I suppose, polite and organised. You know, we got the river and there'd be one fish in the pool down and there'd be five people sitting.
Yeah.
Whoever's in the pool, done his turn, fished and worked it down. Next one goes in.
Yeah.
Like a conveyor belt, you know?
Yeah, well, there's a certain amount of...
There's some sort of etiquette.
Yeah. And, some people don't agree with, oh, I'm going to fish where the hell I like. I wonder if they were sitting on the bank and someone else did it to them, would they find it acceptable?
Yeah.
And I don't think they would. And, people miss out a lot of things. While there's three or four people sitting on the bank and someone's in the pool, you know what tactics he's using, what line he's using, how big his flies are, not necessarily the patterns, how he's fishing. And you see him go through the pool, any luck?
Yeah.
I'm not going to use those tactics then because they didn't work for him.
It's nice being out as well. What I've learned is, like, even just watching people fishing, the next best thing to fishing is talking about it.
Oh,
and to sit down at the bank talking about fishing and maybe seeing fish moving or crashing is just another experience.
Yeah.
Well, do you know, we've been talking hour and a half.
Have we?
And there's probably hours and hours or more stuff and questions I want to ask you. So we definitely have to have another get you over here. And we'll structure a specific method or something, you know, or sit in rivers. But going back to rivers, something which I ask everyone now, and you touched on it earlier on, something you've got to think of. But if you had the last evening or the last day, where would you want to have your last cast?
Oh, man, there's so many places, isn't it? Well, I started my sea trout journey, I suppose, on the River Tyvee. And on its day, it's a fantastic river. And I suppose...
A return trip?
Yeah, return trip. It would be up there with the River Tyvee, where there was a lot of small schoolies in, and I could just have a bit of fun.
Yeah.
And just try some... one or two things and think, it's worked again. Yeah. You know, it's like a mad mathematician. You get all these variables, stick them into an equation, and out comes the answer. And you're thinking, yep, QED. And that would do it for me, you know. One pool on the River Tavy.
Nice one.
All right.
Well, thanks really much for coming along. It's been really a good learning curve as well. There's always things you can learn as well. But listen to the stories, and especially like the one where you, well, you fell in and still played the fish. That says something about your character.
Yeah.
Enjoy the rest of your week off, and maybe before you go back to work, we'll have an evening somewhere, maybe on the Usk or even on the local lake, Llingvawr or something.
Yeah, definitely.
Nice one.
Been enjoyable.
Thanks, Alan.
Thanks, Kerry. Much appreciated.
Tight line. See you soon.
Cheers.
If this is your first time tuning in, make sure you catch all future episodes by clicking subscribe via the links on my website, castingwithkerryjones.com, or via iTunes or your favourite podcatcher. If you like what you've heard on this episode, feel free to drop me a line via my website. Tell me what you've enjoyed, ask a question, or better yet, tell me what you want to hear more of in the future. And if you're looking for additional tips, tackle reviews or venue information, or just want to see what's been hitting the back of my net lately, search up Casting with Kerry Jones on Facebook or follow me on Instagram. And if you still want more, I'm regularly uploading video content onto the Casting with Kerry Jones YouTube channel, so just check that out and subscribe over there too. Wherever you follow, subscribe, comment or message, I look forward to catching up soon for a good fishing chat. Well, I think that's all for now. So until next time, tight lines, and don't strike too soon.